wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss two important cases regarding genocide in Gaza. Alyssa Vitale joins us to talk about enhanced service districts. And finally, this episode, Bill Resnick speaks with Liam Crisson about the transit equity movement. First up, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about court cases against Israel and their ongoing genocide in Gaza, and a federal case charging the Biden administration with aiding genocide. Talking on the left and the law, here's Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, Mike, most of the court cases that we have followed here on Left and the Law center on charges against big oil and their role in poisoning the planet. Today, we take up the South Africa case before the International Court of Justice at The Hague, charging Israel with genocide, as well as a federal case against the Biden administration here in the U.S., charging Biden officials with aiding genocide. But I'd like to start with the California case and with testimony by Mohammed Herzala, one of the plaintiffs in that suit that is moving forward in federal court in Oakland. Quote, "We have lost so many people, but there are still many more who are living, and we owe it to them to do everything possible to stop this genocide. I've done everything in my power. I've participated in protests, sit-ins, wrote letters to my representatives, civil disobedience. Now I am asking the courts to end this ongoing genocide," unquote. Well, for the hundreds of thousands of people protesting this war here in the U.S. and around the world, Herzala's grief-stricken testimony resonates deeply, as does his moral urgency in calling the court to intervene. So, Mike, let's start with that case in the federal court in California with charges of aiding Israel, U.S., aiding Israel in its genocidal assault on Gazans. Is the 1948 Genocide Convention the basis of this case in the same way it's been cited in the South African case?
Well, yes, it is. It was filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights and was heard before Judge Jeffrey White in Oakland in a remarkable session. I mean, the lawsuit tracks the South African case in that it presents first evidence of Israel's emerging genocide against Palestinians. It puts in as evidence the use of starvation and dehydration as weapons of warfare. You know, Israel is essentially running a prison with more than 2 million people residing in it. They control the flow of food, of water, of everything except air. And complaint in Oakland not only notes that, it notes, of course, all the destruction, the bombs. There's been like 12 cemeteries destroyed, residential property. And of course, every public building is being bombed day by day. The death toll rises. I note the complaint was filed in November. It says the Palestinian death toll has risen to 11,000. Now it's way more than double that.
Yeah, I was struck in reading this 89-page document, much like the very long one, similar length by the South Africa team, and how much both of them lay out a deep and long history, which I guess is part of the argument of sustained genocidal intent. Going back to the Nakba of 1948, and both of them are riveting reads and instructive reads on the history of Israel's treatment and military assaults on Palestine.
I've learned a lot from reading these briefs. They're both phenomenally well written, which I rarely say about a legal complaint,
having written many of them yourself. So how would you compare the two? Obviously, the International Court of Justice is the highest court within the United Nations, has a much bigger world stage than the case that's based in the federal court in Oakland. Let's start with the federal case here and the significance of it and the Biden administration's grounds for seeking a dismissal of the case.
Well, I originally had little hopes for this federal case. I mean, people file federal cases all the time, but unlike the South African case, where not only is there a world stage, but you're also, they go straight to the merits. The issue is, are they committing genocide? And what are the grounds? What are the evidence? What are the arguments for? What are the arguments against? But in federal court, I would expect this case to be tossed out on grounds that it raises a political question. Courts are traditionally supposed to deal with judicial issues, and they're not found to have jurisdiction over what are called political questions.
And that's the Biden administration's argument for dismissal.
Yeah, and in Oakland, they're not saying we're not complicit in genocide. They're saying you don't have any jurisdiction to decide this case. But the U.S. has tripped itself in a way by its strong advocacy of the application of international law against Vladimir Putin and the whole Ukrainian efforts within the effort to hold Russia accountable, and specifically the president of Russia, for what's going on there. And they have relied on international law principles, which I rely on in my death penalty cases. There are called jus cogens. There are principles and rules. There are treaties to which we have signed and sworn to follow that do apply. And what the complainants are saying in Oakland is that if you really believe this and pay attention to the language of these treaties to which you have sworn allegiance and sworn that you would follow, you must acknowledge you're being complicit in genocide now. And the judge, Jeffrey White, has been remarkably supportive of this lawsuit. He's 78 years old now, which to me says he's much more free to do what he wants to do because he no longer has a career to develop. His career is what it is.
You're familiar with this judge through your own cases?
Well, actually, yes. He presides over one of my death penalty cases, and he hasn't really been fabulous at all. But he has been fabulous in this case. He's allowed testimony, which he did not have to do. He has allowed really moving testimony, and he's allowed that testimony to be live streamed so people can see people testify, like plaintiff Omar al-Najjar testified from a hospital in Gaza. He says, I have nothing but my grief. This is what Israel and its supporters have done to us. They've put in testimony from Palestinian Americans with relatives in Palestine who have lost 60, 80 family members. They've put in really touching, really affecting testimony. And he allowed this live streaming to go out to 1,000 people on Zoom, and it was oversubscribed. And now it has been captured, so you can go to Truthout and other places and watch it. And that's, he didn't have to do any of that. That was his discretion. I don't think that he's not going to find Joe Biden complicit in genocide, but he is allowing the case to be made. And in the final events, you know, courts do not have troops and machine guns at their disposal. They really are an effective way of amplifying and expressing public opinion. And what has happened in that federal court has been far more than I had thought could ever be allowed to happen in a district court.
There are a few points made in the amicus brief that I wanted to ask you to comment on, because there are points I have not seen in any other cases or commentary. And they're in response to Israel's claim that their military actions are a form of self-defense and the Biden administration's support of that same argument. This is from the brief. Quote, Israel sustained military hostilities and assaults against Palestinians, even when alleged to be self-defense, breach fundamental principles of international law. As the occupying power, Israel cannot both exercise control over territory it occupies, the occupied Palestinian territory, including Gaza, and simultaneously militarily attack that territory on the claim that it is a foreign or imputable to a foreign state.
Well,
what do you think about that argument?
Well, it should be made because they are treating Hamas as if they were some sort of general power. equivalent to like Russia or Bolivia or some state, when actually Hamas is a group that they themselves financed for years because they were worried about the secular left as represented by the Palestinian Authority. This is a group of people who are, they're in some ways, they're crazy, as are the present people running Israel. And the people who are running Israel now would have been regarded as kooks 30 years ago, but now they are in mainstream power, and the most extreme Zionist visions of gobbling up territory to the west and to the south are in full flight right now. And that many of their statements have been quoted by both these lawsuits about how they want to make it impossible, to make everybody voluntarily move, to lay waste to everything. These kind of statements have been made not just occasionally in an immediate reaction to what happened on October 7th, but systematically making these statements days after, and even statements before they were made by Israel. So this particular legal point is a sound one. I mean, how can they say that Hamas is a foreign power when Hamas is, however dreadful they are in their ideology and however unpopular to Israel now, they are the ones who actually initiated this, and they were selected by Gazans. That's why I think many people in Israel say everyone is complicit, even babies and mothers, because they have all, and in some senses, there is some logic to what they're saying, because anyone with any spirit living in a prison is going to think about breaking out. And the people in Gaza have been essentially incarcerated since 2007, periodically bombed. I mean, there is a really touching movie on Netflix called Born in Gaza, which was made by a Spaniard in 2014, just after the last round of bombing. And it's children, mostly 8 and 9 year olds of the feature, walking through rubble, unending rubble, the destruction of neighborhoods, of concrete buildings. And they're wondering about the people they saw killed in front of them, relatives. And some of the kids want to like disappear into the sea. Others want to join the resistance. There's a range of thinking ahead that would be typical of any 8 or 9 year old.
And you know, now there are, I don't know if it's a majority, but a significant number of journalists and media reporters have been killed or have had to flee Gaza. And so there are fewer and fewer reports coming out of Gaza. And so it makes the case before the judge in Oakland particularly important, given the strangling that Israel sustained, strangling of reporting out of Gaza.
You're right. That's a very important point. It's almost impossible now to get direct reports live on the ground. Israel does not allow that to happen. They have strict controls over what electronic vibrations can leave Gaza and what can enter. And they are exercising those control. And the case is not at all frivolous. I mean, Israel has announced its genocidal assault, and Biden and his officials have expressed unconditional support. They supply all the 2,000-pound bombs. They have closely coordinated with Israeli officials. They've pledged and provided tons of military financial assistance, as well as lots of equipment.
And also support through bases in the area.
Yes.
So what is the likely course of a case like this? It was good that the judge kept it before the rejected. I don't know if that was a one-time or ongoing process of reviewing the Biden administration's call for dismissal. It is going forward now. What's the likely course of this case?
Well, the plaintiffs have asked for a preliminary injunction. They've said it's so obvious, so powerful, and such irreparable harm is being done that we need to stop it now. Now, that's not going to fly, but it all depends on, I think, how much more evidence gathering the judge will allow to happen. I mean, there's going to be a motion to dismiss filed and ruled on. And if the case is dismissed, then it will go up to the Ninth Circuit and essentially will disappear, given the time limit, what's going on in Gaza now and the pressures internationally. This is going to resolve itself one way or another before the Ninth Circuit ever makes a final decision. But
well, go ahead. Do you want to make some final comments?
I guess my final comment is we've squeezed a lot of juice out of this lawsuit. It's had a profound effect on all kinds of people. It continues to be shown and observed. And it's not at all a frivolous lawsuit. I would not expect much more to come from it, but I have hope that there can be like something like an evidentiary hearing. But I doubt it. I suspect this court will finally withdraw on the grounds that this is, after all, something to be decided by the executive branch of government and not by the courts.
And then there's the January 26th ruling by the International Court of Justice. Interestingly enough, the president at this point is an American, and the ruling was considered pretty favorable given predictions of what the court would do, that it ordered Israel to do all it can to prevent death, destruction, and any acts of genocide in Gaza, and they have to report to the court. Of course, Israel is, quote, rejects this with disgust, that it's blood libel spread by South Africa. They make a lot of currency out of that old anti-Semitic trope. What do you think about this ruling? And, you know, the final decision takes years. So it's how this plays out in any horizon of time that's going to make a difference to all of these people dying daily in Gaza.
Well, they don't have any more guns than do the federal courts of the United States. So they cannot stop Israel. But the court did order Israel to prevent and to not commit genocidal acts. It's supposed to punish any public incitement to commit genocide. It ordered Israel to ensure the provision of humanitarian aid to keep people alive. It ordered Israel to preserve evidence related to allegations of genocide and to submit a compliance report within 1 month. So I thought it was a pretty fabulous ruling.
But Israel's already pretty flagrantly defying that ruling. What are the consequences of that?
Of course they will. But these orders will, they stop short of ordering a ceasefire, but they did order all sorts of compliant efforts and efforts to respond back to the court and to stay in touch with the court. We'll see how it goes. It's had a profound effect all over the world. It's been featured in every news site on this planet. And the South African brief was, as you noted earlier, they made it clear that October 7th did not emerge from, like, it wasn't just an expression of unutterable evil coming out of nowhere, that there had been a long history, that those Palestinians who live in Gaza weren't born there. They were chased there by Israelis, that they went all the way back to 1948, and particularly to the years since 2007, when Israel withdrew and essentially Gaza became a prison camp, and what it's been like living in a prison camp. So
there was also quite a bit of history on strategies of peaceful protest. The first intifada and then the second intifada was violent in a way that registered the failure of serious peace negotiations, and young kids who have been arrested and rounded up for very minor infractions and encounter with IDF members and Israeli police. So the history of this, there's always this question of how you either justify violence or explain it. And I think a lot of social scientists try to explain how forms of violence emerge among the oppressed when other actions fail.
Well, of course, it's very easy for some people to conflate explanation with justification. We want to explain things. Everything has roots, causes, forces that tend to make it happen. And efforts to explain that are not always, although they can be, an effort to justify. We are operating in a world where cause and effect is not the, they're both slippery concepts, but what the South African brief did was it made it very clear that these acts, which Israel begins every discussion of this war with on October 7th, did not happen in a void.
So we'll continue to follow these cases, both the South Africa case before the International Court of Justice in The Hague and the one here in California. I think both of them suggest or register something about the broader social movement of identification with Palestinian struggle, with the oppression of Palestine and Palestinians, and the recognition of the International Court of Justice that South Africa had a recognized dispute. They had standing with the court, I think, registers the global impact of what's happening there, and also the legacy of apartheid and its identification with, like, the Goldstone report years back and other reports describing Palestine under Israeli occupation as a form of apartheid. So it's a kind of profound time for social justice movements and human rights movements. And the courts often, though, can be very disappointing in what they can deliver. Any final thoughts before we sign off on this today? And we'll be returning to it, of course.
Well, I think the courts are typically disappointing, but here I've been inspired by both these lawsuits. They do what lawsuits can at their best do. They've organized a tremendous amount of evidence in coherent ways. They've made a point. They're moving public opinion and on a solid basis in a way that courts are uniquely equipped to do.
And to tell a story on a bigger stage than would sometimes be available to particularly the marginalized and oppressed.
That's true.
Okay, thanks, Mike. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking on the Left and the Law today about the cases against Israel and Israel's genocide in Gaza, cases before the courts.
Yeah!
Sleep Now in the Fire by Rage Against the Machine here on KBOO Radio. That followed Left in the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Up next, Alyssa Vitale joins us to talk about murky contracts, lobbyists for local business, and threats to public transparency. Here's Alyssa Vitale for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Imagine a city where the streets are policed by private armed guards, commercial real estate developers govern street health and safety, and money intended for sanitation lines the coffers of business lobbyists, all while politicians turn a blind eye. This dirty and dangerous world sounds like a nightmare, but it really exists, and it's here in downtown Portland. Downtown Clean and Safe is the oldest of Portland's three Enhanced Services Districts, or ESDs. ESDs are a public-private partnership. The city subsidizes a private entity to effectively tax every property in the designated ESD zone to fund services beyond what the city offers. In the case of Clean and Safe, the private entity is the Portland Business Alliance, or PBA. PBA is an anti-tax lobbying group primarily representing multinational corporations, banks, corporate law firms, and commercial real estate companies. For nearly three decades, the Clean and Safe contract with the City of Portland has allowed PBA to control massive resources while policing public spaces and lobbying against progressive policy, all with virtually no oversight. Through Clean and Safe, PBA collects over $5 million each year. Every property owner in the zone is mandated to pay into the ESD, not only big businesses and commercial property owners, but also homeowners, nonprofits, and public institutions like Portland State University, the City of Portland, and Multnomah County. Nearly 20% of the Clean and Safe budget comes from public institutions, meaning tax dollars fund the ESD. But neither ratepayers nor the public can influence Clean and Safe. The ESD is governed by a self-appointed board, and it's impossible to tell where PBA ends and Clean and Safe begins. There's significant overlap between board members and staff members for the two organizations. All but one Clean and Safe employee also works for PBA. And the Clean and Safe contract pays significant portions of the salaries of seven PBA staff members, including 45% of CEO Andrew Hone's salary and half the salary of a key lobbyist, PBA's government affairs director. Clean and Safe also pays $26,000 a year to sit on the PBA board and shares the cost of office space with PBA. By covering significant PBA costs, Clean and Safe subsidizes one of PBA's chief activities, lobbying. And PBA's lobbying efforts are prolific. Over the past decade, they lobbied city officials seven times more than any other organization. PBA has played a significant role fighting local, progressive, grassroots initiatives like charter reform, universal preschool, tenant protections, and Portland Clean Energy Fund. Since public institutions are Clean and Safe ratepayers, public money essentially subsidizes PBA lobbying against policies that voters approved. Clean and Safe does not even directly provide the safety or sanitation services in its name. Clean and Safe contracts out for cleaning and controversial safety programs, which include paying salaries of extra Portland police officers, hiring private security firms to patrol public streets in the ESD, and, most recently, a downtown hotel security zone. This new public-private partnership within a public-private partnership siphons even more public money to ESD personnel. These irregularities have not gone unnoticed. In 2020, Portland City Auditor conducted an audit of the city's ESDs. She found that Portland had limited oversight of ESDs and zero guidelines for ESD formation or governance, which led to over-policing and prevented public oversight. The auditor recommended the city review the ESD program. 1 year later, Clean and Safe's contract was up for renewal. City Council had not yet responded to the audit, but PBA lobbied hard to renew its contract, despite significant public opposition. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty proposed a one-year renewal to complete the audit response, then reassess. Her amendment was voted down by Mayor Wheeler and every other commissioner, Maps, Ryan, and Rubio. Clean and Safe's contract was renewed through 2026. Around the same time, the city hired an ESD coordinator to lead the audit response. This staffer dutifully engaged in public listening sessions, but before he could report his findings to city council, his contract was not renewed, and many of his documents vanished from the city website. In 2023, the city hired BDS Planning to review the ESD program. BDS consults on establishing, managing, and renewing place management districts, another term for ESDs. BDS founder Brian Douglas Scott actually authored 1985 Oregon legislation that enabled ESDs like Clean and Safe to form. BDS's pro-ESD bias shows in the firm's draft report on Portland's ESD program, which cites concerns that ESDs raised about the 2020 audit, but minimizes the public pushback against ESDs. After releasing their draft report in a poorly publicized meeting, BDS accepted public comment for just 1 month over the winter holidays. Now, on February 14th, BDS will present its final recommendations to City Council. It's unlikely the ESD evangelists of BDS will recommend pausing the ESD program, and even more unlikely that the PBA-friendly City Council will take any action that might jeopardize PBA's control of downtown or their executive salaries. So what can we do in response? One, show up for public meetings and comment. Do not allow this problematic public-private partnership to fade into the background. Two, demand transparency and accountability from our public officials. Especially as a new batch of city councilors take over, we must remind them that they serve the people of Portland, not the business alliance. And three, demand investment in essential public services like sanitation and behavioral and mental health. We should put our money into services that benefit everyone, offer good union jobs, and have public oversight, like the popular Portland Street Response or a public sanitation department. The people of Portland deserve a better downtown than what business lobbyists are giving us. It's up to us to demand better. Why do we got to do about the rich? Why do we got to do about the rich? Why do we got to do about the rich? Come on.
About the rich.
are we going to do about the rich by Pet Shop Boys here on KBOO Radio. That followed Alyssa Vitale for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Finally, this episode, Bill Resnick talking with Liam Crisson, a researcher at the Institute for Policy Studies, about his recent essay, Transit Equity Movement Wins Their Biggest Zero Fare Victory Yet. Here's Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, Liam Crisson. Welcome to KBOO here in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you for having me, Bill. It's a pleasure to be on your show and talk about an issue that matters so much to me, transit equity.
Yes. Liam Crisson is a researcher for the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He was first assigned to the Institute's Global Economy and Inequality team, his first research project centered around public transportation reform as a means of pursuing race and class equity. This research ultimately produced a widely shared article about a successful free fare initiative, Free Transit Fare Initiative in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And the title of the piece is The Transit Equity Movement Wins Their Biggest Zero Fare Victory Yet. So, Liam, let's start with the need for more public transit and why it needs to be electricity powered and free. And then we can discuss in the second half of this interview how to operate to get public support for building out the system. So first, Liam, in Albuquerque, enlarging public transit and making it free was driven by equity demands. So what do we mean by equity? And tell us the story.
Well, one big aspect of equity is as we're building our cities, you know, denser, and as the populations of many previously smaller cities is getting bigger, we can't depend on car-centric infrastructure anymore. I mean, to begin with, car-centric infrastructure excludes those who either cannot afford maintenance of the car or cannot afford a car at all. The American Public Transportation Association estimates that depending on your location, you could be spending anywhere between $12,000 to $17,000 yearly just in upkeep and in gas just to own an automobile. And that could be in comparison with the cost of public transportation itself. So that's a lot. That can take up as much as 30% of the income for working class families. So from the very start, building cities around cars is an equity issue. And it's also an environmental issue. You know, the areas that will be hit worse with congestion tend to be in the environmental impacts of, you know, automobile building will be lower income neighborhoods. You know, the famous example is the way in which the Cross Bronx Expressway in New York impacted the lives of Bronx residents and how Robert Moses built the bridge in a way to avoid the impact on the Upper East Side. But in general, just building more equitably, building public transportation, transportation is a lifeblood of a city. It connects residents to their resources, medical resources, educational resources, and community resources. You know, we talk about a crisis of loneliness in the United States. To build more connected communities, we have to have easier ways to get around. This is why the United States takes less commutes than other developed countries with more adequate ways of getting around easily.
Part of the problem, I think, is housing was made into a commodity and in very short supply. So many people have to wind up even paying 50% of their rent way out in some suburb without an automobile. It seems to me that just so limits the lives of many, many, many millions of people here.
The housing issue and the transportation issue are inextricably linked. These are very connected from the fact that, you know, building public transportation, if not matched with an adequate housing policy, could actually raise rents in surrounding areas. They're inextricably linked. But there are some solutions across the country. There's talk about building new stations with high density, mixed use housing around it. It's good, you know, because we have to move past single family housing. I myself grew up in New York. So I grew up in mixed use areas. And it's nice to be able to walk to a deli and not have to drive everywhere. So there's a quality of life standpoint as well to not worrying about parking wherever you go. There's the equity, there's the environmental, but then there's also just quality of life from being able to live close to things that aren't just other single family homes.
Right. You mentioned the environment a couple times. It seems to me there are two major environmental issues. at least. One, electrified transit replaces fossil fuel burning and is one of the absolute necessities in saving us from climate change. The second environmental problem that burning fossil fuels is on people's health. The air in cities is, in some cities of the world, the lifespans are much, much shorter, like New Delhi or Beijing, for the unbreathable air that people are forced to breathe. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we don't even have to look as far as New Delhi. We could even look to Atlanta. You know, in the late 90s, it was deemed a non-attainment zone because of how bad congestion was. It was then that a lot of transit started to be expanded. It's not being expanded in an equitable way, but there's a real fight on the ground to make that happen. And the fight continues in Atlanta. But it's public transportation, particularly using electric vehicles, even without, you know, just having more people traveling in one bus. One bus carries so much more people than single individuals in a car. And it's just a more efficient way to get people around, reducing the amounts of greenhouse gas per trip. But if we can get that as low as possible, that's what we got to do ASAP to reduce the impacts of climate change, but also just to reduce the impacts of adverse health on youths growing up in the cities. You know, there is a measurable and rapid increase in quality of health in areas that have improvement to rapid transit. You know, this is both from the standpoint of the pollution of cars being reduced, but it's also from the standpoint of connecting them to health resources that would otherwise be harder to get to.
You know, on a human level, I think of the terrible air. It's not just high amount of carbon and dust. There's terrible air in huge pockets of our cities, particularly where the poor live, and that's expressed in the asthma rates. Very large, up to 20% of kids in that area have serious asthma problems.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them die from.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and people who live near these highways die sooner of heart disease and other bad air contributed to their early deaths. But that's how our cities were designed and transportation systems, and especially, of course, the big sedan.
And the biggest thing about this is that it doesn't have to be this way, but we have to shift to a longer term mindset. You know, public transportation is going to be costly to build up, but once it's built up over the long term, the benefits will pay in many dividends for generations to come. I mean, if we look at, there's a lot of factors that go into Tokyo's system being one of the few profitable systems, but it is, the government invested an immense amount into this system before they saw any kinds of profits. And it is cheaper than the New York subway. And I think the problem is that we stop short of funding it to the point where it can actually serve communities. That's why only 5% of commuters in the United States ride public transportation. Those 5% are often cluttered in areas like New York City that actually have pretty adequate public transportation. And there's a real mindset shift that needs to happen, because when we're spending on public transportation, we don't see that the result, the profits aren't going to come directly to the agency that's actually maintaining the transportation network. It's going to be seen in the community around it. There is if we were to invest over a 20-year period in public transportation, we would see $5 billion back for every $1 billion invested. And a lot of that is in increased productivity of being able to get to places without spending all this time parking. But most of it is in investments in businesses, in local businesses. And that ties into one of the big issues that we saw with COVID. You know, a lot of cities are experiencing a lot of failure with small businesses. It's difficult to keep the social and cultural fabric of many cities alive, because a lot of businesses that kept that alive are going broke. And one way to keep these communities alive is to just have more foot traffic, you know? And that brings me to free fares. The argument for why we shouldn't pay at the fare box, we should actually pay with our taxes, is that one of the major reasons cited for the 95% of Americans who do not ride public transportation daily is high fares. You know, they don't want to spend as much as they do now at the fare box. We already fund so much of these systems with our tax money. It's just going the extra step is more productive because we spend so much money to actually make sure that people spend fares. We spend millions in New York to make sure that people don't hop the turnstile, but those millions could be directly going into funding the system, you know? If we just shift to a tax-funded system instead of a partially fare-funded system, because it really isn't mostly funded by fares,
no,
it cuts out a lot of inefficiency.
It's very inefficient. More money is spent, at least I've read, in collection of the fare, enforcement of the rule, and safeguarding the money and the cash box and all of the rest of the stuff that goes into collecting money and then transferring it into accounts and all of the rest of it. It's an expensive proposition. And the expense of it in many places is much greater than the amounts that they're collecting. Just in the enforcement, you have to have people running around trying to stop people from jumping the in New York City, where I spend some time. In many stations, people wait outside the safety doors, but they're just to keep people forced into going through the money line. They're jumping the barriers. So there's an enormous amount of now in the city, and people open the doors when asked, generally, by people who are obviously not able to make the 275 fare. And I think that happens in a lot of places where bus drivers just don't want to be enforcement agents. And in fact, when they do, they have sometimes get disputes, right? And most attacks
in
most,
in most disputes, most disputes with between passengers and bus drivers occur over fares, you know, because we're putting the bus driver in the position where they also have to police and administer fares. That puts a lot extra on their role, you know what I mean? They already have to worry about getting everybody safely from point A to point B, and now they also have to make sure that, you know, people are not skipping out on fares. That adds a lot more stress and unpredictability to the job. And that's why, going to the piece I wrote, there was a lot of bus drivers who supported free fares in Albuquerque. And as you mentioned, yes, in smaller systems, Albuquerque is a big city, you know, metro areas around a million, half a million in city proper. You know, it had a smaller and mostly an entirely bus system. During COVID, you know, the cost of administering fares was higher than what they were bringing in, you know, and that shouldn't ever happen. You know, that's just a massive inefficiency. There is a big problem, though, with when we switch to tax-funded instead of fare-funded systems, we have to ensure adequate funding. And that's where federal policy comes in. Currently, federal funding only accounts for 7% of public transportation allocations, only 7%. And that's because the federal government typically has only contributed to capital investments. That's a new bus, new rail. You know, that's new projects, but not really making sure that those projects are successful once they're up. That's the ribbon cutting stuff, you know, when you have the new station and it's all a celebration, but is it actually running, you know, every 15 minutes or is it every hour? You know, this is important. Is it actually connecting people with the resources that they need? And so during COVID, the federal government potentially set a new precedent because they started funding public transportation systems more directly, more completely to keep them alive through COVID, because throughout the world, you know, most people were staying home, or there's a lot of people who had to keep going out and risking their lives just to keep putting food on the table or to keep, you know, everything running. So I don't mean to erase those people who kept society afloat during the worst years of the pandemic, but many people were staying home. Public transportation systems lost ridership, and it was really hard for them to recover. That's why we're seeing so many problems right now. They're still recovering. Even as ridership is up, it's not the same level. Because of remote work, it's not the same level. And that's why there's talk throughout the United States of budget cuts. That's the worst thing that we can do, you know? Just because the system can't pay for itself, it's unrealistic to expect the system to pay for itself. as I said before, the benefits are seen in the community, not in the transit agency itself. And yeah, it's also a great direct subsidy on working class Americans. You know, it keeps more money in their pockets. You know, a lot of people in Albuquerque who were struggling to make ends meet, but were using the bus to go everywhere, that saved them, you know, tens of dollars every week. And that goes directly into food and other essential things. So this is all important, but we have to make sure that we do it right. And it does, there's a lot that can be done at the local level, but there has to be change at the federal level as well. You know, only 7% is abysmal.
Yeah. Imagine if the U.S. wasn't funding its military so that it has more firepower and personnel than the next 10 countries combined, including China and Russia. Imagine if that money had gone into public transit.
And it would even take only a fraction of that money of the Pentagon's budget. It would take only a fraction of that to actually be able to adequately fund public transportation. You know, it's going to be slow. If we wanted to fix it all tonight, it would cost billions. It would cost hundreds of billions. But I don't think we can fix it all tonight, but we have to start fixing it tomorrow. You know, this has to start as soon as possible. If we're going to survive climate change, we have to speed up rapidly the clean energy transition. That begins with public transportation. As you're saying, our current infrastructure, which emphasize roads over public and active transportation. So active transportation being biking and walking, instead it emphasized roads. It's trapping everybody, forcing everybody into driving everywhere. You know, I have friends in Atlanta, which is a very car dependent city, who say, I would like to take the bus. If it was more reliable, I would like to take the bus and use that as a primary mode of transportation. It's not pleasant to drive everywhere and to lock myself into polluting the environment unless I can afford an electric vehicle. But yeah, you know, we're seeing a moment of you know, record-breaking infrastructure investments, the most infrastructure investments since Eisenhower, but not enough of that is going into public transportation. That's where it really needs to be going. We're stuck in the mindset of thinking that the car is the future. It is not. The future is in I love New York, but it doesn't have to be like the New York subway with rats everywhere. You know, we can put in the money to make this a good system, and we're going to see it pay off long term. As I said, 5-to-1 ratio. Every dollar put in, 5 out into the community. That's a massive money multiplier effect. So this is a really good way to strengthen local economies, reduce inequities in our society. As I mentioned before, you know, you save $13,000 on average trading out your car and taking for public transportation instead. That is, $13,000 is a lot, you know? So again, I said it's a class equity thing. It's a race equity thing. People of color are far more likely to be taking public transportation than white people in the United States. And so this really hits a lot of bases at once. That's why, as I say, is that transportation is an everything issue. You know, it's race, class, environmental, and even just general quality of life for everybody.
Well, that's all for today. We're about to exceed our time limit. So to wind up, in my intro, I announced that Liam Crisan and I would discuss the need for a vastly expanded public transit system, that it became accessible to nearly the whole U.S. population. And that would greatly alleviate and reduce the multiple diseases and problems the current transit system causes. Thus, it would eliminate the 28% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions caused by fossil-fueled vehicles. It would clean the air and improve health and increase life expectancies. It would enable poor people who cannot afford autos and forced by ever-increasing rents to live in desolate communities. They could go to work and medical appointments, buy better food, and see families and friends. It would also save national resources by greatly reducing the need for cars. All that was covered today in today's interview. And in part two, we will show that the new public transit system can be successfully completed if our designers and engineers pay close attention to the challenges and potentials of local conditions. That part two will be coming up soon. So thanks, Liam Crisan, who recently wrote the article, "The Transit Equity Movement Wins Their Biggest Zero Fare Victory." Thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been the Old Mall Variety Hour for the 5th of February, 2024. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Liam Croissant, Alyssa Vitale, as well as Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.